This is the Cubs-related podcast presented by CubsInsider.com. My name is Corey. I am joined, as always, by Brendan, and we are coming to you on Sunday, April 25th. The Cubs and Brewers just finishing up a three-game set at Wrigley Field, and the Cubs dropping the final two of this series. So another series win for the Brewers. Unfortunately, that is a lot of series wins for the Brewers against the Cubs in the early going, and these two teams don't see each other for a while. So we will put a pause on that rivalry for a bit. And Brendan, you know, this was another in a series that I feel like we've seen frequently to start this season, in that it was a winnable series that the Cubs ultimately drop, and it started with a huge offensive performance, a big win for the Cubs on Friday. You felt like the vibes were good heading into the weekend, and as I ended the last podcast, you know, the Cubs had gotten back to 500, and it felt good. It felt like we could kind of do exactly as I'd hoped and ride that to a nice streak, a nice stretch here. And then they drop a couple of pretty frustrating games on Saturday and Sunday to be back at 10 and 11.
But we do have Nico Hoerner doing well, making smart plays defensively, hitting line drives all over the place. Absent of that, those last two games, I think the overall immediate future looks a little bit brighter than it was a week ago. Jake Arrieta calmed down, got his bearings straight. He looked good for six innings. And I think, again, just the overall picture for the immediate future, given that we have Nico up, given that you're seeing Bodie get more results, given that you're seeing Jake Marisnik and Duffy contribute, I think for the next few weeks, it's going to be tough. But I'm not going into these 2 weeks as, you know, pessimistic as I may have been a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it's starting to sound like a bit of a broken record, but this is just kind of the deal with this team. It's going to come down to games like Saturday and Sunday. Sunday, the score, I don't think necessarily reflective. It was a 6-0 final for the Brewers, but I don't think necessarily reflective of how close the game was. It was basically 1-0. It was literally 1-0 for the entire game, and then it got off the rails in the ninth inning. But it's going to come down for this Cubs team to those tight games, and especially against a team like the Brewers, who at this point might find themselves as the favorite if you look at some of the projection models on FanGraphs or anything like that. In this NL Central, these are the types of series and these are the types of games that you're going to need to win. So like you said, Brendan, there are a lot of individual positives, a lot of trends that I think have this team going in the right direction and hopefully can come together to lead to better overall results. But in the meantime, you know, this is it was a frustrating weekend because you do feel like, you know, that 4-3 loss on Saturday and, you know, Sunday's game being 1-0 for, you know, eight innings and feeling like it was a winnable game against a tough starter in Woodruff, but not able to pull it off. You kind of feel like those are the boxes you're going to need to check going forward to have a better overall result. But we will talk about the individual good stuff, some of the bad stuff, and everything in between. Let me do a quick recap of these three games to set the table. As I said, on Friday, it was a 15-2 win for the Cubs. That put them at a game over 500 at 10-9. A nice start from Kyle Hendricks, six innings, six hits, two earned runs, one walk, and six strikeouts. He got bit by the home run ball a couple times, but no worse for wear. A nice quality start and a win for Kyle. We also saw Kyle Ryan come in behind him for two innings, so good to see Kyle Ryan out there, a solid two innings for him. The Cubs getting their runs in this one. Anthony Rizzo and Javi Baez hitting back-to-back home runs, always fun. Jake Marisnik getting his first home run as a Chicago Cub in this one as well. Wilson Contreras would add to the fun. In addition to that, the Cubs 15 runs on 17 hits. Some other of the scattered RBIs coming off the bat of David Bodie. Jake Marisnik has a bases clearing double in this one as well. A three RBI double there. Nico Hoerner with an RBI double in this game. Jason Hayward with an RBI triple. and Austin Romine actually getting on the board with an RBI double late in this one. So that was the tale on Friday. On Saturday, it was a 4-3 loss, a frustrating one. The Cubs took a 2-0 lead early in this one in the bottom of the second on the aforementioned Nico Hoerner, an RBI double that scored two. But the Brewers would score four unanswered runs in this one. Jason Hayward would cut the lead to one in the bottom of the eighth with his second home run of the season, but it would not be enough as Josh Hader closes the door on the Cubs, and that was all that she wrote. Adbert Alzolay was pretty solid in this one, not allowed to continue and try to pursue the win, which I think was the right call from Ross, but you know, bringing in Rex Brothers, it gets a little murky. It's hard to say, but we'll have to continue to see how Ross lets Alzolay go deeper into games, how he's using the bullpen, etc. I thought it was a fine decision in the moment, but overall, Adbert goes 4 2/3, 2 hits, 2 earned runs, 2 walks, and 7 strikeouts. Obviously, the 7 strikeouts jumping out at you there, got a lot of whiffs, was really effective with a lot of his stuff. So again, I think a building block start for Alzolay. But again, a 4-3 loss was the result on Saturday, and on Sunday, it ends up being a 6-0 win for the Brewers, but I don't think that really tells the tale of the game. It was 1-0 early. Jake Arrieta started with a very spotty command. In the first inning, he walks in a run that looked like it was going to be the only run of the game. But after that, Arrieta settles down big time, retiring 15 in a row after that first inning. He ends up going 6 innings, 2 hits, 1 earned, 3 walks, and 8 strikeouts. So much like Alzolay, the strikeout was in play for Jake Arrieta, and he gets himself another quality start. Unfortunately, he is hung with a loss just because of that walked-in run. Jason Adam would allow 5 earned runs, Dylan Maples helping him out with that. Not good from either of the two of them to relieve late in this game, but like I said, it was really a 1-0 game, and Brandon Woodruff was the story for the Brewers, and you know, the ninth inning was putting it out of reach for the Brewers, but that was all she wrote, Brennan. So again, it started with a big offensive explosion, you know, like we talked about when the Cubs offense was struggling so much at the beginning of the year. We knew there was going to be those games where the lineup felt deep. Everybody in the box score was contributing something. You've got different guys hitting home runs, different guys racking up multi-RBI games, and it just didn't carry through the weekend. And this is something we've seen with this Brewers team, Brendan, that they are really good at locking down these close games, these one-run games, these, you know, 4-3 games. Sunday looked like a 1-0 game that the Brewers were successfully locking down until they scored more runs. So at some point, I think throughout this season, to win this division once again, like they did in 2020, the Cubs are going to have to get better and more consistent at winning these close games.
No doubt. And that's kind of where I'm thinking right now, is how can you improve some of the fringe aspects of the team? And so is that in the bullpen? Is that in lineup construction? Is that in defensive alignment? Like how do we make it so that these one-run games, if they keep happening, which they might, they end up winning more of these? Because to lose that one-run game on Saturday, and again, even though they lost 6-0 on Sunday, it was basically a one-run game the entire time. How do you make it so you have more opportunities to win those games? And I think there are possibilities, and I'll be curious to see at what point the Cubs actually start messing around and trying to mix and match and find the right combinations to win those types of games.
Yeah, and I think that that's going to be a big discussion on this podcast as we near the end of the first month of baseball here, you know, just several days left in April. Is it time? When is it time? And how do you kind of look at that in terms of improving things on the margins, right? 1 month isn't necessarily a long enough sample to make official declarations on certain players or situations and things like that. But you do kind of start looking at the calendar, and time is slowly drifting away. And in a division you know is going to be tight, on a team that has so much potential variability, you begin to wonder, when do we kind of have to look at some of these things to make some changes, shake things up a little bit, and how do you want to pursue that? So we will talk about that first, Brendan. While we're just talking about this Brewers series, I wanted to get your thoughts on the pitching performances of Alzolay and Arrieta in particular before we move on to, you know, maybe looking forward as to what the team should be doing with the roster or the lineup or the bullpen and things like that. So while we're kind of wrapping up on this Brewers series a little bit, what did you see from? I'm especially curious your thoughts on Alzolay because, you know, I think his thing early in the season here, you know, obviously you want him to be going deeper into games. We know he's going to be on somewhat of an innings limit. He's already been doing the kind of up and down, go to the satellite thing. But especially in these last couple starts for him, it's obviously clear that the stuff is there, the potential is there. And it feels like it's close to, you know, kind of clicking and getting more out of him. But we've talked about the Cubs' need for someone in this rotation to give them more length, both Arrieta and Hendricks giving the Cubs six innings on in their respective starts on Friday and Sunday. But what did you see from Adbear in particular in that game on Saturday, and how do you think he's going to factor into all of this going forward?
Alzolay looked good, Corey. The problem, if you want to call it that, is that it's hard for him to go deep into games right now. So you know the Cubs are trying their absolute best to be cautious with them, probably given last year's COVID season and his recent injury history. But when he's out there, he's looked phenomenal. And I think his start on Saturday may have been his best start, visually speaking, here of the year. So he threw 83 pitches. 44 of those 83 pitches were sliders. This is kind of like what we saw Yu Darvish do at certain points in his Cubs career and his tenure, is he went predominantly to that slider, and he was working the rest of his pitches off his slider. And that's what Alzolay did. So he threw 44 sliders. He got 9 whiffs on those sliders. He got 8 called strikes. He got a ton of strikes just by throwing those sliders. And then he played the four-seam off it. He played the sinker off it. And he got 2 whiffs on his four-seam. He got 2 whiffs on his sinker. And he threw 38 total pitches between the two. So looking at that and seeing some of the swings he got and seeing how confident he looks on the mound, especially in some high leverage situations, I like the feel. At some point, he's going to go deeper into games. There's just no doubt about it. And I don't know when that's going to be. Of course, you want it to happen as soon as possible. But once he's allowed to go deeper and have a longer leash, this is an extremely interesting type of pitch arsenal, because you don't typically see young pitchers do this. I'm trying to remember, even in like recent Cubs history, I've never seen a young pitcher come up. First off, we never really see them anyway. But when they do come up, they're not throwing these types of unorthodox arsenals where you're pitching backwards. You're pitching your slider first as a starting pitcher. Really fascinating, and I think it's working so far. And I'm excited to see more. I think this is someone who was not a slider pitcher a year ago, wasn't even a sinker pitcher a year ago, and now he's basically exclusively those two pitches, stand some of those four-seamers. So overall, love watching him pitch, really encouraging. It's just a matter of time and when he's allowed to go deeper, and if he is allowed to go deeper, maybe he steps up and surprises people, and he becomes that top three guy that you can rely on when you need whiffs, when you need to limit the contact.
Yeah, I certainly think, you know, obviously of the group that we're going to be looking at, I think he's got the most potential to do that. And I find myself, you know, really looking forward to his outings, just because, you know, you feel like he's about to take that step, or just the person most likely to take that step and give you, you know, maybe those really exciting, like, dominant outings.
And the attitude he has.
Yeah, I think that's part of, you know, kind of what I'm saying about just feeling like he's got that potential and he's that guy. Like, he does have a presence out there, and it's just about putting it together and having the patience with him. You know, he's another guy where his track record and his experience level at the major league level is not very long. So, you know, you have to be patient with him. And like you were saying, Brendan, with his innings limit, his potential pitch limit, and just, you know, being careful with him kind of like someone like Nico. They're different guys, but their long-term development is the main focus, not necessarily how can we quickly get them to contribute in 2021. So it'll come with Adbear. Again, I think this was another positive step. Length and being able to carry some of the dominance that we've seen from him in particular innings or in particular stretches over these starts, that's the next step that really kind of continues getting you excited about him. And I think the next step that I would imagine Ross and Tommy Hotovy and everybody want to see from him, how do we get him to get through the fifth, get six innings, start to get up there, you know, maybe seven innings, keeping that dominant stuff, keeping the strikeouts coming, but getting more length out of these games. So with regard, Kyle Hendricks looked good on Friday. He's Kyle Hendricks. You know, if there's ever a time where we need to pause and talk about Hendricks for any particular reason, we will, but I don't think there is. He's just Kyle Hendricks. He'll get better as the weather warms up and the season wears on, and you know, he gets his arm you know, where he wants it to be, his mechanics and everything like that. So it was a good start on Friday, and he'll continue to deliver good starts. I don't think there's any particular insight on Kyle Hendricks at the moment. But want to highlight Jake Arrieta again, and I know, Brennan, I'm sure you have some particular thoughts on what he was doing with his pitches and his mechanics and things like that. But really simple for me, his starts so far in his return to the Cubs, in order, 6 innings, 1 run, 6 innings, 2 runs, 5 innings, 3 runs, 5 innings, 1 run, 6 innings, 1 run. Perfect. That's exactly what you're looking for from him, right? This is a guy you signed to a short-term deal for not a lot of money, to be a middle-ish rotation kind of guy, bring him back home, feel-good kind of thing. He's giving you exactly what you could have hoped for from him. As I've been looking at with some of these guys, he's certainly keeping the team in the game every time. He hasn't given up more than 3 runs in any of these outings. He's gone at least 5 in all of these outings. He's gone 6 in 3/5 of the outings. Like, he's not vintage Jake Arrieta. It's not that same guy, but he's been effective. He's giving the team a chance to win. He's picked up 3 wins himself. The loss he takes on Sunday, completely undeserved by him. And I just don't think you can be asking for anything else. This is, at least so far, a picture-perfect reunion for a guy who struggled in Philadelphia and who you were bringing back to contribute exactly what you're looking for to this rotation, especially when you add on what he means to the fans and what he's able to contribute in this clubhouse, as we've seen so much since spring training with guys like Alzolay and stuff like that. So this has gone really well for Jake, and particularly on Sunday, very impressive for him to be able to settle down after that rough first inning, because this was one of those starts that easily could have gone off the rails and put the Cubs out of reach, especially with Woodruff on the mound and what the Brewers are able to do with their bullpen and holding down leads. This could have been a game that you could have written off in 20 minutes if Jake had not been able to settle down, get the outs, and keep things tight. I'll let you dig into some of the particulars, but just from a results standpoint, right, this is about as good of a low-risk signing as you could have asked for. It's only through 5 starts, you know, so we're not super deep into this, but I don't think you could have asked for a better start from Jake Arrieta in his reunion with the Cubs.
Well, you're seeing that veteran mindset that he has. When I say veteran mindset, it's the ability to adapt within the game extremely fast. And we saw that twice in that start today. The first time after he walked Shaw with the bases loaded to bring in a run, locked it down, got out of it, and did not even give up another base runner for 15 straight batters. So that is who Jake is. For some reason, when his stuff is not there or it doesn't look good, I don't know how he does it, but he escapes these jams. And he did that throughout 2017 and even 2016, even though the numbers were not like, you know, what it was in 2015. But he was still able to get through outings when his stuff or command was not there.
Ice in the veins, man.
That's exactly it. But I think today, the stuff was fine, and I think the stuff has been fine the entire year. What has been shaky for Jake is the command, and I feel like even in his first five starts, the command is not what he wants it to be. That's just my feeling, my interpretation. If you watch where, in this case, where Romine set up today behind the dish, there's no data to back this up, but I feel as if he missed like 80% of his fastball spots. Like, there was so many instances where the catcher was setting up on the lower outside portion of the dish and Arrieta would miss up. And for the first four innings, all of his sinkers, like almost all of them, were either at the belt or even higher. And I think it's kind of funny though, because going into this start, with his sinker, he only had eight whiffs, like through his first four starts with the sinker, only eight whiffs. And then he ended today's start with six sinkers whiffs. And I think unintentionally he got those whiffs because those fastballs were up in the zone. And we've heard Tommy Hotovy and Jake Arrieta saying that they're going to attack the lower outside portion of the dish. That's just who he is. Go for it. If that's what makes you comfortable, if that's your way of pitching, then there's no way of getting out of that. But it's just kind of funny to me to see Jake, when he's not intending to get those whiffs up in his zone, he like unintentionally got them. But also too, one last point with Jake is once when he got to that sixth inning and he got into another jam, the difference this year to years past are many, but the biggest difference, at least in terms of recency, is his curveball. So his curveball this year is just a better pitch. It just moves more and it has more vertical break. And he used that pitch to get out of that sixth inning. And you saw it. Let's go back and watch that sixth inning. Those 80 mile per hour curveballs dipping down and in the lefties are beautiful pitches. And so far this year, he's throwing those pitches, those curves, with 5 more inches of vertical break. So even if the command is not there with Jake, you know that weird release point, that crossfire action, that wild tailing action on that two-seamer, it's gonna be hard to hit. And so you may not be able to locate, you may not be able to command to the degree you want to command, but because that stuff is so nasty, you have more margin for error. And again, like, Jake did not have that curveball last year. He talked how he could not throw crossfire because of his knee injury. Now that's fixed, and now even despite having, you know, suboptimal command, he can still get three innings, and that's exactly what we saw today against a pretty good hitting team.
So I think that's gone about as well as you can hope for, and I think you can pretty much count on Jake to give you a solid outing. They're like anybody else. He's going to have some clunkers in there probably, but I think everything we've seen in terms of the stuff, the pitch usage, his ability to adjust, and everything, I think you just have confidence with him out there on the mound. And again, you know, I'll just go back to, like, you know, he's just better because he's not with the Phillies. But that's a discussion for another day. So what I want to get into now is kind of what we alluded to at the beginning. I don't know that there was anything like major in terms of, like, we've been talking about a lot of these guys, Rizzo, Brian, Contreras, Happ, et cetera. And we're going to talk about some of them in particular. But in terms of just like their offensive performance, I don't know that we saw anything this weekend that has drastically changed a lot of the stuff that we had focused on in the past few episodes. But I want to get into what we were talking about in the beginning, which was the margins for this team, the little adjustments, changes, whether it's in the lineup, the bullpen, the roster as a whole. Because to me, and I think you would agree, Brendan, like, this, we knew coming into the season that this was going to be a highly variable team, right? That they had the potential to be on the good end of things. They also had the potential to be on the bad end of things. It is a roster that is just built that way. This is not the 2016 Cubs, where you just expect them to show up and beat whoever they're playing into the ground. They're going to win 100-plus games because they're just too talented. That's not who this team is, right? But I think when you look at this series with the Brewers, this series that they played with the Mets prior to that, and even that one against the Braves last weekend, the key in all three of those series, we saw the Cubs have at least one offensive performance that was an explosion, right? Like over 10 runs. Around those games, though, is where I think this season is going to be won and lost for the Cubs. And I think a good juxtaposition, which you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know is my favorite word. The Mets series and this Brewers series, I think, is a really, really good comparison, because in the Mets series, the Cubs have an offensive explosion, and surrounding that, they have some closer wins, right? In this Brewers series, they explode for 15 on Friday, they lose a one-run game on Saturday, and they lose what was mostly a one-run game on Sunday. And so it begs the question, or you know, sort of incites the conversation around, are there things the Cubs need to be looking at? Maybe they don't have to do them yet. Maybe some of them they do, some of them they don't. But are there things that you want to be looking at as we near the end of the first month, right? And like I said, it's not necessarily a long enough sample for some of these things to make the sweeping conclusions that you may have to make or that you would like to make about some of these things. But in a division that is going to be close, with a few teams probably going to be in the mix for the duration of the season, it's going to come down to series like this weekend, you know, how you perform in the division, how you do in one-run games, things like that. There's a lot of stuff to look at in terms of, do we want to stick with this, or do we want to move on from this, or do we want to change this up a little bit? And the first place that I would like to go, Brendan, is with Ian Happ in the leadoff spot. Now, I want to preface this conversation by hoping that you guys have listened to the past few episodes where we've talked about Happ, because if you had, you would know that when I ask this question, it is coming from someone who has been very adamant about praising Happ's overall approach, his plate discipline, his ability to take his walks, and a lot of what he's doing. And you know, you've heard a lot, they talked about it on the Marquee broadcast and stuff, and you'll see it all over social media and in the writing, that his expected numbers throughout the season, not necessarily in the immediate past, but throughout the season, have been good. He deserves better than the line that he has. So I want to preface with that, because I don't want it to get twisted that this is necessarily a negative conversation about Happ. It's just asking questions as we end a month of baseball here. My question to you, Brendan, is at what point, right, you especially are always fond of the expected stats, looking at the Statcast numbers, looking at exit velocity, launch angle, things like that, and saying, did Ian Happ deserve better than this ball finding, you know, Jackie Bradley Jr.'s glove or something like that, right? And for most of this season, the answer has been yes, right? He deserves better than a 521 OPS because of his approach, his batted ball profile, everything. But as we near ending a month of baseball, how long can you look at those expected numbers and say, we're sticking with this process, we believe in this process, while your leadoff hitter has a 521 OPS? Because on a team that has struggled to score runs at a lot of times in this season, you know, when they're not putting up a 15-run effort, you start to, again, wonder, where can we maybe be making changes? Should we be making changes? And I haven't offered a position on this, but I do think that if, you know, the calendar turns to May and you're leading off with a guy who's got a sub 600 OPS, people are going to start to ask the question, and I don't know that it's an unreasonable one to ask. So would you be looking at that now, Brendan? Do you think it's a crazy question? Stick with the process. The results will come. Where are you on this?
So the tricky part when I think about this is, if you make a change, if you move Happ out of the leadoff spot, does that disrupt his process?
Sure.
So if you move him down to the 5 or 6 spot, can we assume that what he's doing in the leadoff spot persists in that type of new role? And I think that's a fair question, and that's my holdup. Now, assuming that that type of approach does persist, if you move him down to the 5 or 6 spot, it has always been my preference to bat someone like Ian Happ in the middle of the order. When you have the potential to hit 30-plus home runs and see so many pitches, I want that type of profile hitting with more men on base. It's just a standard that I always have. Now, given some of the issues with the team over the past 2 years in the leadoff spot, I think it does, and even now you can have the argument, it does make sense to keep Happ in the leadoff because he does take many pitches and he does walk. But over the last now year and a half, 2 seasons, you're seeing, from my point of view and from the numbers side, sustainable changes to Jason Hayward's approach. And I float the idea, this is not a super strong opinion, but it's just when we have this discussion of how can you improve the margins, I do think it's a fair discussion. Hayward's different than Happ in terms of how he hits particular pitches. And as an example, I mean fastballs right now. And before 2019, the second half of 2019, Hayward could not hit fastballs. He's worked really, really hard since 2016 to change that. And so far in the early going here, despite Hayward also not having like good numbers, he's still hitting high fastballs. And so if we look just at the like expected batting average of high pitches for Ian Happ, right now it's like 223 and below in those upper thirds of the zone. It's just really bad. And if you look at Jason Hayward in those same regions of the zone, so the upper third portion of the strike zone, he's batting almost with an expected batting average of 300, right? Now, in terms of the entire sum, you brought up the expected numbers. And I think, of course, you want to look at the expected numbers because that tells you what you can expect going forward, assuming there's no changes and assuming that these guys continue to hit the ball well. Happ, if you look at the last 8 games, really bad, really bad process. And if you just take his like rolling average, expected weighted on base average, it peaked at 390 a week ago. And then today going into Sunday's game, it's like below 325. So now it's below league average. So it goes to show you that despite the first 2 weeks, despite the first 14 or so games of Happ looking good, for whatever reason, the last 8 games or so have not been good. And I think it goes to show you that when you have someone with Happ's profile who sees a lot of pitches, but it's not going to make a lot of contact, and when he does make contact, it's going to go far, it sounds like a Javi Baez. It sounds like a Jock Peterson. It sounds like a Kyle Schwarber, those types of hitters. And those are great because you could go through stretches and you could have men on base where all of a sudden you run into a 3-run home run. And that's valuable. And that's something that you're not going to see as often when Jason Hayward's batting 6. And Jason Hayward right now has very similar plate discipline numbers as Ian Happ. Happ's a little bit better, but even Hayward right now is well above league average in terms of his chase rate, and they're very similar when you compare Happ's and Hayward's together. So my thinking is this, Corey, just to reduce it down to like one common thought. I think given Happ's inability right now to hit high fastballs and his overall inability throughout his career to not make consistent contact, my thinking is that that's going to lead to a more inconsistent, volatile, prolonged stretch from the leadoff spot. And we want to mitigate and reduce that variability. So from that point of view, when you have Jason Hayward, who's showing good plate discipline numbers and is making well above league average contact, and just look throughout his recent career, the peaks and valleys are going to be a little bit more even for Hayward. And from the leadoff spot, I want that. I don't want to go through a week stretch where you cannot get on base, and then the following week you're going off. That's, people are going to make the argument, well, you know, that week they go off, you're going to win those games. Sure, that's fine, but we're talking about trying to improve the margins, and I don't want to bank on that because there could come a point where that contact rate is not salvageable. And it's happened so many times for these types of hitters in the past, including Javi recently in 2020 in the first part here, and including Schwarber throughout his entire career. So these high whiff guys, they are extremely volatile. And I get it, and I love Hap, and I want to point that out too, because I think he is best probably served in the middle of the order. And it's not to knock him, but I think where I'm at right now, I want to give some consistency at the top of the order. And my thinking of doing that is to put someone who makes more contact while still not swinging at bad pitches, even if he has less power. And that's Jason Hayward. And Hayward is a veteran mindset guy too. He's gone through so many phases in his career, and I don't think that we should look at his recent adjustments as like nonchalant. Like, I think these are major adjustments he's made. He's put in so much work to get to that point, so much so that I think it's reflective that he could end up being a decent leadoff hitter if he has some time to work on it as well. So I don't know the solution to this. Maybe the best solution is against pitchers who are not heavy fastball guys to throw Hap for now, but if you're facing heavy fastball guys, which they're going to in the next 2 weeks, maybe Hayward is the best option in this current moment.
Where I would generally land is I would probably leave it alone with Hap as long as he's leading off as a lefty. I'm not the biggest fan of him leading off if he's switching to hit from the right side. It's his weaker side. And I think that might be an opportunity to mix things up if you want to do it. I would leave it for now, but I'm monitoring it. Let's put it that way.
All right.
Because
so, I mean, what's going to change your mind then? Like at some point, like the Brewers are better than we thought, man.
Sure.
Like Burns and Woodruff in their rotation, like they're better than we thought, and the expected projected standings are trending now in that direction. So we're entering May. At some point, you got to make a decision.
Yes.
Here. And so like for you, then when is that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to see how
it's a feel thing.
Yeah, it's a total feel thing. And you know, yeah. Ultimately, the person whose feel matters the most is neither of us. It's David Ross, really. Or I guess maybe if Jed Hoyer feels strongly enough about it. But I think it's again, it's a feel thing, and striking that balance between you know, again, I know you pointed out that it hasn't been as good of a process from Hap in the immediate past, but or you know, immediate recent games. But in general, I think, you know, his overall approach and the expected output should be better. But it's the balance between that and you got to get results, right? Like the games aren't won and lost on expected batting average and expected slugging percentage and expected WOBA and stuff like that. Ultimately, the results have to come. And that doesn't mean, you know, you sell out for guys that are getting lucky or anything like that. Like, you know, if someone like Eric Sogard was just blooping a bunch of hits that are obviously, you know, pure luck and positioning, you don't just go, oh, well, he, you know, we got to play him more. Like, no, but you have to feel it out a little bit. But with Hap, the results have to come, especially because he's the leadoff hitter, right? Like, and that's why this is a position that since Dexter Fowler left has been such a point of discussion for the Cubs, because you want to be. You want it's exactly like this, and it was similar for Schwarber at the time in 2017 when this was happening too. Like, you want to be able to look at what they're doing as an individual player and say, okay, this is good. This part of their approach is good. You know, these changes or these things not changing is good. I like this. We should believe in this. At the same time, though, this guy's getting the most plate appearances on the team, and you need to get the results because it obviously has an effect on the entire rest of the lineup. It has an effect on the entire rest of the offensive output, because of course it does. So it's a tricky spot, right? And I agree with you, Brendan, much like we talked about with a lot of these guys in the past, there's always the worry that whichever decision you make is going to mess with them long term, and so it's a delicate balance, and it's one of those times where I'm glad I'm not the person that is tasked with making these decisions, because it's not an easy one. So for me, I totally know what you're saying with Hayward, and I think a lot of the process that you're putting out there is right. I think the natural sort of devil's advocate that I assume some of you at home are thinking is that I don't know how strongly I feel about moving a guy who's currently hitting 212 with a 646 OPS up to the leadoff spot is, like, is that worth disrupting Hap or not just letting his yeah. process play out a little bit more? But I do understand, you know, a lot of the merit, you know, contact-wise, approach-wise, from maybe looking at Hayward. Again,
I mean, you have the expected numbers, and I it's not like we're like I bring up numbers a lot, but you do have to recognize in this short sample, you are extremely limited on how you interpret this, and you yeah. do have to watch these games.
Sure,
and I know I'm not going insane here with this. If you watch Hayward the past 10 games or so, for me, comparing that to Hap, I feel better about Hayward's approach.
Yeah, no, that's...
And some of the numbers back it up, maybe some of them don't, but you have to be a little careful how we interpret the data at this point.
Sure. I think that, you know, I don't even necessarily feel strongly about this. The thing I feel strongly about more than anything is that I do think that however they go about it, you know, Hap is going to be better than this. He deserves a better line than this, and I don't think there's any wavering in terms of Hap being a productive member of this lineup. And I want to reiterate that the only reason we're talking about this is because we're almost at the end of a month, and this team's success or failure is going to rely on little decisions, right? They're not going to be able to get away with talent alone or just how deep their roster is or things like that like they have in past years. It's going to come down to, like, each individual decision and how that works out on a daily basis. So we'll see. It's just something to keep in mind. And again, like, I don't even know how much of a discussion we're having about this. If Ian Happ's hitting in the sixth spot or something like that with the approach that he's had and believing like he's deserves some better luck and has struck the ball well, but, you know, hasn't gotten the hits to fall in. I don't even think we're really talking about him. I think the conversation around him is, yeah, it'll come. You know, he deserves better. The process is pretty good for the most part. It'll be fine, right? But when they're the leadoff hitter and you're talking about a sub 600 OPS, it, you know, sort of starts to become a point of discussion a little bit more. But I want to stay on some of these sort of decisions on the margins, and I already know what your answer is going to be, so I'm just going to throw it to you.
All right.
Just go ahead and talk to us about Nico and how he's never allowed to leave this team.
I mean, he cannot go back down. Yeah. It's just that simple. I mean, you saw him play left field this weekend too.
Yeah.
And that goes to show you the versatility the guy has. He can play any position, man. He can play third base, shortstop, second base, left field, center field. I'm sure if he had to play right field, he can figure it out. At some point, you do have to recognize that the best chance for winning games has to include Nico Hoerner. There's no argument for me if you want to win now, and maybe you don't, and maybe that's part of the process. If you want to win now, there's no convincing argument that can be said that you can win now without having Nico Hoerner there. Like, you're not going to have your best opportunity to win if Nico's down. And I think right now this team needs consistency, right? Like, when we're going on double-digit wins to being shut out and losing these low-run games, that's because a lot of these guys' approaches, as we've seen for 4 years, are hit or miss, and they have the same type of weaknesses. A lot of these guys, although they're improving this year so far, they've had trouble hitting high fastballs. They've had trouble hitting fastballs in general this year. Nico's doing all of his damage in his current stint against fastballs. That's been all of his base hits besides one base hit against fastballs. And he's peppering the ball to right field, to center field, down the line. He's making smart defensive plays. He's making diving plays to second base. He needs more playing time. And that's probably part of the discussion of why he's not up right away. So the solution is, give him more playing time. And then in terms of when Jock is back, then figure it out. There's got to be ways to figure it out. Also, if we're talking about the fringes, when Jock does come back, you're going to have to make a decision about his playing time against lefties. And if there is a decision to be made there, then you have an open spot with Nico Hoerner. You put KB to left field, you move Bodie to third base, and you start Nico at second base. So I think it's possible this guy cannot go down Corey.
Yeah.
He can't go down. He's hitting fastballs all over the place, and he's done that. He just needs consistent playing time, and he's a different hitter than he was last year with his open batting stance and his increased athleticism and his natural growth as a young baseball player. Give the guy a chance. He deserves a chance.
As we've seen a little bit more over the last week or so, you know, especially in that Mets series and a little bit this weekend, he just provides what I think this team needs more of, and more of what will help them avoid those stretches where the offense is particularly putrid, right? Because he makes more contact. He's got a good approach. Like you said, he's doing damage on fastballs, which is not something everybody in this lineup, you know, is always doing. He's athletic. He's a good base runner. He's an excellent defender. I think you have to find a way to keep him on the team. The long-term development, like I mentioned earlier, is the priority. But I think with the way things have played out here and the way that David Ross has shown a willingness to move things around and try different lineups or things like that, I think there is a way to get him the proper amount of playing time. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be true. And that doesn't mean that you have to stop giving David Bodie playing time or not do a good faith effort of giving David Bodie that opportunity to prove himself, right? He's his own unique situation. I think you should be able to do all of this in a way that doesn't harm any of these guys in terms of their playing time. But I think, and it's not just going off of these few games that we've seen from Nico, but we knew kind of who he was in his profile, and we know what he still needs to do to be where he wants to be in his career. But when you're looking at this team and what they need, I think he's got the potential to be bringing a lot of that stuff. And when we're talking about cleaning up on the margins and winning close games and doing those little things that win you close games, Nico is just such a good candidate for all of this stuff, man. You know, he's going to be someone that can hit situationally, can make contact to the right side of the field when you need to move a runner over, things like that. He can run on the bases when you need him to, bring that athleticism on defense. And like you said, Brendan, he's like so many guys in this Cubs organization over the last few years. He'll play wherever you want him to. If he needs to be out there before the game with Mike Borzello or whoever taking balls at catcher, for all I care, like, Nico will do it. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
He's athletic. He'll do whatever the team needs him to do, right? So I think unless David Ross has some particular reason that he just cannot get him in the lineup enough, which when I'm looking at this, I don't see necessarily why that would be the case. I think you'd probably be giving the wrong people playing time if that were the case. I think you have to try to find a way to keep him, because I think the diverse profile that he's bringing relative to a lot of his teammates is really necessary for this team. And I want to stay on that a little bit and kind of talk about a little bit of what you mentioned in terms of when Jock comes back and what he looks like. You know, I think I mentioned earlier, you know, maybe being treating Hap as a right-handed hitter a little differently than when he's hitting left-handed. David Bodie, you know, in terms, you know, he played third base on Sunday. He's someone that can move around to still get that playing time. Chris Bryant looks good in the outfield. When you're looking at this offense and the guys who we're generally seeing on a daily basis, are there beyond, you know, we talked a little bit about the leadoff spot, even though I don't know that we really reached a definitive conclusion between the two of us. But anything on this offense that you would like to continue to see more of? I know we've talked about Jake Marisnyk kind of a lot between the two of us. And, you know, he got some starts this week, had a big game on Friday. But anything in terms of tweaking this lineup or tweaking how some of these guys are playing beyond what we've already discussed today?
Well, it's so difficult to have like a confident opinion because Jock's bad performance may have been influenced by that wrist injury. And it's all to say too, even when he comes back, you don't know if that wrist is 100% healed, or you don't know what the lingering effects of a wrist injury is. Those are bad injuries, man. Those can come and go and mess up, you know, months at a time for your season. So I don't know what to think. I don't know if his lackluster start is because scouting reports got against him, or if it's predominantly driven by an injury. That also then goes to the question, how long do you want to wait to find out, right? And if he does come back, it's not even a guarantee he comes back in, like, you know, after the 10 days. If he does come back, I don't see the argument that makes sense to bat him against lefties. Like, I just don't see it.
So now let me ask you this. How do you feel about the kind of way that we were told that whole conversation went down, right? Because the way we were kind of presented the information was that Jock was told he's the starter in left field and then he's going to get that opportunity. Now, just because Jed Hoyer told him that doesn't necessarily mean that there is some sort of legal, like, binding contract in that regard. I don't believe that that is something that is, like, that some sort of games played minimum is in his contract or anything like that. So this is probably just a conversation thing. Do you feel like there is a point at which the Cubs owe that to him, or they can just say too bad? Like, how do you kind of balance what we were kind of led to believe about the situation? Because what he wrote, like, in the Players Tribune and how he talked about it was like, this is why I signed here, is because of this ability. And, you know, of course, it's only been, you know, a few weeks, so it does feel a little early. But as we're talking about, it might be something the Cubs have to consider if they're prioritizing competitiveness. But how do you feel about just that situation?
Yeah. There is I'm trying to find the quote, but I can just paraphrase. There was also words Ross said was, well, if you're batting like around 180, you're going to have to sit. And Ross did say that. And guess what? He's batting
around
180.
Well, after 3 weeks, though?
He's going to come back in like a week, man. This is May. Yeah. So this is not April 5th anymore. So it sucks that he got injured. Yeah, like we all know it sucks. And it's not his fault. But it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, you got to have results. And so if you're going to have someone step up like Matt Duffy or Jake Marisnyk, or now Nico's going to be up and he's looking good, this is a competitive business. You got to make tough decisions. And Jock did get the opportunity to start the year hitting lefties, starting every day. It's unfortunate that he hurt his wrist and someone stepped up in the process, maybe, but that's how the sport is. And I think it's fair. They gave him the shot, man. And they could still give him the shot. We don't know what's going to happen, but I don't think it's unfair if he were to come back to not get as many plate appearances against lefties. I think right now the Cubs are in a division race. They have guys who are performing better than expected, perhaps, when he comes back. And it's not fair to those guys who have made changes, like Marisnyk and Nico and Duffy. It's not fair to them to not get playing time when they're getting their results. So that's where I'm at. And I'm conflicted because Jock looked great in spring, and it's not to say, hey, you know, because he looks great in spring, give him the chance. But it's such a stark contrast that the way I'm thinking is that wrist injury had to have played a role in that just snapping of the fingers, quick decline where he's not hitting fastballs anymore.
Yeah, it's a tough spot, and this is sort of the spot that the Cubs and Jed Hoyer put themselves in to a degree with how they built this roster, and, you know, having such a roster that has so many guys on short contracts, prove themselves type contracts, expiring contracts. It does get a little tricky as to how you want to manage all of this, but I think the main, like, point of this conversation that you and I had today, I don't think was meant to necessarily offer definitive solutions or conclusions to a lot of these things, but more so just to start the conversation and highlight some areas where if you are looking at 2021 and this team being competitive and trying to continue their reign as the NL Central champions, there are decisions you'd have to be making in the interest of doing that, in the interest of the 2021 team. and winning games. And these are just some of the areas where you're going to have to start looking. And, you know, the Jock situation is tough with what they might have promised him or what he might be hoping for. And again, you know, it's such a small sample so far, but there does come a point where you are going to start to look at someone like Matt Duffy, who's making more contact and maybe provides a little more of that against left-handed pitching. Someone like Jake Marisnyk, who is another guy, you know, who brings a nice set of skills, not someone who's, you know, necessarily should be playing every day or all the time, but get him in there against a lefty. And, you know, he had a big game on Friday, and he's got that speed. He's got the defense. Another guy who just sort of gives you a different type of personality from a lineup perspective. So it's something they're going to have to consider. And I think it's, you know, it's really highlighted by kind of like the Nico Horner situation and what they're ultimately going to do with that. But real quickly, yeah, before you do the series preview for this Braves series coming up, just a quick touch on the bullpen. I think we all know kind of the deal with the bullpen. It's a lot of guys who have some pretty heavy strikeout stuff, a lot of guys who walk too many guys. Overall, as a unit, they are walking way too many guys. It's a problem for the unit as a whole. And on that same note, right, I think we're getting to the point where you're going to have to start tinkering with that a little bit. And there's different guys who you may want to continue giving a look to, some guys who you might be on your last look at them, whatever it is. But this bullpen just has too many guys who they might get some whiffs, but they walk too many guys. And it's too inconsistent. And we saw that a lot early on, and we've seen it through this season. You know, you look, and they're all different. So if I list them together, like, they're not together in terms of their performance or anything like that. But, you know, like Maples, Rex Brothers, Brandon Workman, Dan Winkler, Ryan Tepera, like, you know, those are guys who can get outs, they can get whiffs, but they also are so inconsistent. And if the command isn't there, it's going to be bad, right? And, you know, there's other guys in the bullpen, but, like, Sunday was a really good example, I think, of kind of the problem with how this bullpen is constructed and why, you know, you might want to bring Strope back. You might want to bring someone like Justin Steele back, or just start trying different guys, because we're a month into this, and you can't just keep giving some guys opportunity after opportunity after opportunity and hoping that something changes. Like, Sunday was a really good, I think, kind of microcosm of this, where Jason Adam gets himself in trouble. Jason Adam's a guy who I think has good stuff, but is, you know, not immune to this same problem where the command isn't there and it's a mess, right? And it was a mess on Sunday. And then you're looking to bring someone in to put out the fire, right? And other than Craig Kimbrell, Chafin's been good on the season. He's been, I think, big in a lot of spots, but he's also struggled as well. His ERA is sitting at 5, right? So I don't know if he's the type of reliever that you'd like to be your second out of the bullpen behind Craig Kimbrell, right? If, you know, Rowan Wick came back, maybe you can move him down. You feel a little more comfortable with that. But, like, other than Kimbrell, really, like, who are you, like, the bases were loaded. You need whiffs, but you also need somebody to not let this inning spiral out of control. Who are you bringing in, Brendan, right? You've got an entire bullpen where you have no idea if the guy's going to come in with the bases loaded and walk in a run. And David Ross tried Dylan Maples, and that's exactly what happened. Two of them, right? So it's just one of those things where I say that's a microcosm of the problem with the bullpen as constructed, because I think it's a bad spot where when the bases are loaded and you need somebody to put out a jam, you have, like, basically one person that you're confident, like, yeah, this guy will come in and not make this fire way worse, right? And I think Chafin might be in there, but he's had some, you know, some not-so-great outings as well. So I think you have to consider shaking some of this stuff up. And, you know, like, whether it's Dylan Maples or Rex Brothers, with a lot of these guys, I get what they see. I get why they want to keep trying. I get what they are envisioning if it were working. But for a lot of these guys, it really feels like you're just kind of spinning wheels, man. And before I let you offer an opinion on that and then ultimately do the preview, Brennan, I do just also want to mention, I didn't include him in this because he's sort of serving a different role, but Alec Mills has been big for this team. And I think it's a credit to him for adapting to this role. I know he wanted to be in the rotation, but Sunday, another two-inning, you know, a multi-inning outing for him allows just two hits, no runs, no walks, no strikeouts. But he is showing an ability to adapt to that role and give David Ross and Tommy Hotovy a really nice option to eat innings, move games along, and keep things under control, right? Throw strikes, get outs, pitch to contact, let the defense do their job. And as we've talked about a lot, as the staff has not been giving a lot of length, the starting staff in terms of their outings, you know, a lot of 5 or 6 inning starts, huge for Alec Mills to have accepted that role, adapted to that role, and ultimately, you know, setting himself up to thrive in that role. So he's sort of in a different box, I think, with some of these other relievers.
They're going to get whiffs. They're a nasty bullpen from Stuff. But they're going to have command issues. And the hope is, as they continue to get more work, those command issues for some of them dwindle away. That's the hope. There's no way you can just go into the alternate site, pick someone out, and just assume, all right, here comes a guy coming in with a walk rate below 2.5 per nine. There's no one there that exists like that. Maybe Justin Steele gets that opportunity. He should get the opportunity, I think, next time up. But to your point, you don't have someone like that on this roster. And for now, that may be okay. But when you go into like July and August, and if you are competing, you're going to have to get someone else. It doesn't take away all the success they've had with the bullpen, because it has been an overall strength dating back to, you know, 2020. You're taking someone like a Jason Adam, and you're just completely renovating the guy's career. And they've done that with Rowan Wick and basically their entire bullpen. I mean, Ryan Tepera had the third best whiff rate in the league last year. And in his most recent outing, he had a ton of cutter whiffs. He started throwing his cutter again. He didn't throw one cutter the outing before the last. He comes in this one. He throws 9 cutters, throws it a mile and a half faster, and he's getting whiffs again. So that's the hope. The hope being the stuff is there for the majority of these guys. Now, within the next few months, the next step is maybe one or two of those guys get their command shaped up, because right now that's what you have to bank on. And if it doesn't work, then you go outside the organization, you try to get someone else. That's what they end up doing. But for the short-term picture here, you have no other solutions, and that might be okay. You might go through spurts where you have like different really heavy walk innings, and then you may go through some other stretches where you're striking everyone out, and that's just the way it is. It's volatile. We knew this. It's never changed, but that's all we have right now, Corey.
Yeah, I just think at some point, you know, as a unit as a whole, at some point you got to start getting perhaps a little more aggressive with some of these guys.
But I mean, like what, like the aggressiveness? Like it'd be different if you had alternate guys. You don't have that. Like this is every single one of them has the potential to strike out 12 guys per 9 innings, and every single one of them also has the potential to walk 5 guys per inning for 9 innings as well. Every single one of them. And so that was the thinking. Let's get the nastiest guys possible, which I like. Let's optimize their stuff, which they have and I like, and let's hope a few of them get their command shaped up. So far, it's been kind of a hit or a miss. I think Jason Adam, outside of his most recent outing, has looked really good. And he could be one of those guys where we look back on a month from now and be like, all right, there's our guy who's not walking anyone with that nasty stuff. So I think for the lineup, maybe they don't deserve as much patience because we've seen a bigger sample of what they do. For the bullpen, the sample is still so small. And
well,
I still
but
think
not
it's possible.
For all of them, though. I mean, the sample on guys like Rex Brothers and stuff is pretty large.
The thinking with Rex Brothers is that he's a different type of pitcher, though. So like if you look at Rex Brothers from 3 years... I'm not buying it either, but I'm saying that's the process, though, Corey. That's what they're thinking.
Well,
right?
I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying in turn. You know, I know that they don't have a, you know, it's not like a litany of options, but at some point it's just like, all right, like,
I mean, you can cut bait, but like who are you replacing them with? I mean, again, Justin Steele, yes, but outside of Justin Steele, you have Pedro Strop, sure, you have Brad Week, sure. Those are not surefire options either. If you're looking for like a guy from, you know, as an example, like pre-Joe Maddon, Steve Cizek, who's not going to walk anyone, those are hard to get there. They don't exist on this team right now. And that's the hope.
We need one of these guys back and healthy, I think. And I hope he comes back.
I'm concerned about that injury. I'm concerned he won't be able to come back with that velo. But if it's back, then yeah, a lot of our problems are going to be a little bit less anxiety inducing. So that is a hope. I think that's more of a wait and see game than it is for the lineup, though, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's fair. And I mean, like you said, this is, you know, kind of always how it was going to be with this bullpen. We knew what we were getting into.
Yep. All right. So let's preview the series against the Braves. We have a 4-game series starting Monday. That first game is at 6:10 p.m. Central. We have Zach Davies on the mound for the Cubs. Again, this is in Atlanta, so they start a 7-game road trip. Davies on the year, 1-2, an 8.8 ERA, not good. He'll be facing Charlie Morton, 1-1, with a 3.91 ERA. On Tuesday, we have Trevor Williams facing the Braves. Ian Anderson, Williams on the year, is 2-1, with a 4.66 ERA. Anderson on the year is 1-0, with a 3.27 ERA. That start time at 6:20 p.m. Central. On Wednesday, we have the Professor Kyle Hendricks on the mound. On the year, he's 1-2 with a 5.6 ERA. He'll be facing Waskar Nyoa, who on the year is 1-1 with a 3.68 ERA. The Braves have not announced their last starter for the 4-game set, which takes place at 6:20 p.m. Central again, but they have announced the Cubs starter, which will be Adber Alzolay. Alzolay on the year, 0-2 with a 5.4 ERA, hoping to come off that last start, throwing more sliders, getting as many whiffs. The Braves on the year starting off slow, 9-12. The Cubs right now, 10-11. Things to look for. I mean, you guys know the obvious features at this point. We need more consistency from the lineup, hitting fastballs. We got some glimpses of that for the past two series. Look for Nico to get more playing time. Look to see how Ross utilizes Matt Duffy and David Bodie, whether or not he puts KB in the outfield the entire time again. I think those are the features. But at the end of the day, it's just you got to be more consistent. You got to be more consistent with your approach and making more contact. And hopefully that comes sooner rather than later.
Yeah, so the Braves are going to head into this series with the Cubs having been shut out by the Arizona Diamondbacks in a 14-inning doubleheader. The Braves on Sunday in 14 innings against Zach Gallen and Madison Bumgarner get one hit, no runs. So Madison Bumgarner in the second game threw a 7-inning no-hitter. I don't know if that counts as a normal no-hitter or not. That's a new baseball thing. But they score no runs, and they struck out 13 times. So they're coming in hot, is what I'm saying. So hopefully, you know, that offense has a lot of talent in it, but they're not clicking right now. So hopefully this is a good spot for Zach Davies to kind of turn things around a little bit with the way that his season has started. And, yeah, I mean, just want to see more consistency from the offense. I mean, that's pretty much the story. Those big, you know, run explosions where you're getting 14, 15, 16 runs, they're very nice, but you know, clearly we need to spread the love a little bit more to all three games of the series. I know it doesn't work like that, but just a little more consistency throughout the series and, you know, not necessarily having it so much concentrated in one game. You know, still looking at Hap, again, overall, think he deserves better output, still kind of waiting for him to have that big series. I think that would be a big one for him. Continuing to watch where Nico Hoehner is playing and, you know, how often David Ross is getting him in there. And other than that, just, you know, again, it's this is how this season's going to be. It's going to be close series, competitive series. You know, really, for the most part, like there's been several games, you know, a handful where the Cubs have, you know, it's just been a blowout and it just hasn't been close. But generally, these are close games. These are competitive games. And that is how a division that ultimately might be decided by somebody winning, you know, 87, 88, 90 games, something like that. These are the games that really count. The Cubs have got to find a way to be more consistent and pick up these W's in these tight games. And as we've noted a lot, and you know, we saw this weekend, the Brewers are really good at closing down those games, pushing across runs, and shutting things down for the day. And the Cubs, as this season goes on, are going to have to find ways to be better about that themselves. So that is the story of things, a disappointing end to this weekend at Wrigley Field, but, you know, still a lot of positives, and I think things to be optimistic about as we go forward here. And I think ultimately the conclusion as we near the end of April here in several days, this team is, I think, competitive as we thought they might be, right? They're in the thick of it. They can win this division. I don't think any opinion on that should have changed. It's just a matter of getting some of these things clicking, especially in lineup and in that bullpen, and, you know, kind of putting it together and going on a little bit of a run here. I wish it would have started after the 15-run outpouring on Friday, but alas, we will have to start a new winning streak on Monday in Atlanta. So that is the story of things for us. We will talk to you guys after the Cubs and Braves wrap up their series. As always, we thank you guys for listening to the Cubs-related podcast. We will talk to you again in a few days, and as always, go Cubs.